We have a little different show for the next 2 weeks, crossover episodes. John Mayer and I were interviewed on the NCOPD podcast with Jordan Smith. The podcast is about leadership in the military, but Jordan listens to our show and thought there were some parallels between how we teach. So this first episode is Jordan interviewing John Mayer, and next week will be my interview on the NCOPD podcast. Thanks to all our patrons who make this show possible. If you like what you hear and want to support the show, you can do so at patreon.com/coachyourbrainsout. We're offering some bonus content there for our patrons and hoping to do a lot more of that in the future. Now on to Jordan Smith and the interview with John Mayer. Jordan actually interviewed John second, and he says that at the beginning, so don't get confused. I just put John first because he probably has better things to say than me.
Welcome to the Non-Commissioned Officer Professional Development Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Smith, and this is the podcast where we discuss military leadership, professional development, and all things about enhancing the individual soldier's ability to survive and thrive in combat operations. All right, so this is the second part of our Coach Your Brains Out team with John Mayer. I like John a lot. I like listening to him on his podcast, Coach Your Brains Out. He has a lot of really great insights and is very well-spoken and has a very analytical mind, and he's definitely an outside-the-box thinker, and that's one of the main reasons why I wanted to have him on is because he is such an outside-the-box thinker. So I hope you guys enjoy this. It's a second part of our Coach Your Brains Out series, so let's get into the interview. All right, John, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Jordan.
All right, so why don't we start off by just telling us a brief, you know, who you are, what you do, and kind of your background specifically in sports.
So yeah, I grew up playing sports, found volleyball in high school, and not till later in high school found beach volleyball. So, you know, that became my love, and I pursued it as hard as I could. I played at junior college and then played at Pepperdine University and planned on being a teacher, but I decided to pursue trying to play professionally and just didn't give up on it. So I kept pursuing it and ended up playing. I've been playing for about 14 years, both internationally and domestically on the AVP tour. And then all along I've been coaching as well. Like, to be a professional beach volleyball player, you've got to have two jobs to have some sort of steady income, because the seasons can be good or bad, or the tour can go bankrupt, and you never know on that stuff. So I've been coached at a junior college, Santa Monica College, and now I coach at a university, Loyola Marymount University.
Awesome. Actually, let's touch on that real quick, because volleyball, specifically beach volleyball, is a little bit different than every other professional sport. Can you talk about kind of the ups and downs and how that works being a professional beach volleyball player?
Yeah, well, you know, it's I think it's sport sometimes at its purest, because there's no contract. You don't have any guaranteed paycheck. You have to earn every penny that you make. So, and there's it's literally pennies. We don't have a lot of them out there. So you play tournaments and pay to fly out there, and you pay for your hotel. So you're taking risks, right? And you know, you could make nothing, or you could do pretty well. So yeah, it's just you got to go all in with your training. You got to prepare the right way and believe that you're good enough to enter at that level and to actually be able to be successful, so you can actually make money and continue to play volleyball. So it's different than a lot of professional sports, not having that retirement plan or contract or health insurance or all that.
And it's also been shut down a few times, right? Correct. Like, the AVP hasn't been ongoing since its conception. So when you're talking about having a second job, you really have to be good at that second job as well.
Yeah. And I think something that I was very lucky was early on, I didn't just find a second job. I found a career. I found a passion and something that I love to do. It wasn't work. I mean, I work hard at it, but I guess maybe it wasn't a job. It was work. So yeah, I found coaching, and they ended up paying me to do that too, which was nice, because it's something that I really care about and want to be good at. So yeah, I was able to do that and always have at least a steady paycheck and have stuff going towards retirement and have health insurance through, you know, working at different universities. So I got very lucky to be able to do that and have loved every minute of it. And it'll be my career once I'm done playing professionally.
Can you talk a little bit about where you started as a player and a coach and how you've evolved to where you are now?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how far back you want me to go, but I think for a long time, especially in like high school, I fought being a volleyball player. I think volleyball can sometimes have a stigma as a male, the female sport or a girl sport. So, and I just loved basketball and I always thought of myself as a basketball player who played volleyball. So I fought it a little bit. And then as I found beach and as I just got more into the game, I became a volleyball player and I committed to it. But I'd say I wasn't really a learner or student of the game, or I wasn't someone who took things and treated what I did professionally until maybe 8 or 9 years ago. Before then, I was pretty stubborn. I wanted to do things my way. I was less open to trying new things. But you know, I got mentored by a friend of mine and named Tom Black, and a lot of times by example, just seeing the way he went about things, he approached the game in a scientific way. He really valued learning. He was always asking questions, and kind of seeing how he went about things, I was inspired to want to be better and want to figure out ways how I could be better. And so I made a big shift probably about 8 or 9 years ago where I just really invested in being the best learner I could be, being the best coach I could be, being the best teammate. That's really when I feel like I've made the shift as a player, and I made a big jump in my results once I committed to being more open to learning.
So how can you become a better learner?
Well, there's a lot of ways I could go with that. I think, first off, it's a lifelong skill, and it's one of those things that you can never be done with. So you can continually get better as a learner. I guess for me, the first thing was just having the awareness that I was stubborn and I was closed-minded. So I think having some self-awareness is a big first step. And then from there, I think I guess you kind of have to ask yourself, like how serious about, your mission in life are you? You know, do you take it, very seriously? I thought I did. But once I realized I was more closed-minded, I opened myself up. And so it starts in slow steps. I started to read more books about what high-performing athletes did or business leaders or teachers. It didn't matter in what field. Just started to observe someone like Tom and some of the people who just did things at a really high level, Rafael Nadal, people like that. Just looked at where I could add the elements of, the things that they did well into my life. So, I don't know. Yeah. I think self-awareness is a big part of, knowing where you're at and then slowly making changes so you can improve.
You also mentioned in there how you could be a better coach or a teacher. I mean, I imagine a lot of that goes in the same realm as far as opening yourself up and being realistic about where you are, but what other steps can you take to influence people better? You talked a lot about Tom Black's scientific methodology. Has that influenced you at all, or have you incorporated that into your coaching?
Yeah, and I couldn't, I probably will miss a lot of things and not remember what helped me become a better learner, but I don't think you can, or I could, have become the learner I am now without Carol Dweck's research on growth mindset. And Tom introduced me to her research and, the basic idea, it's a belief system. She found that people with a growth mindset had the belief that they could improve at skills, and people with a fixed mindset, thought that skills were fixed. They had this belief that you couldn't, if you weren't a math person, you'd never be a math person. So it's a really simple concept, but learning about that concept and seeing all the research that Carol Dweck did, that if you do have a growth mindset about skills, you improve more quickly. So understanding that and looking at all the areas in my life where I had a fixed mindset and trying to attack those areas and shift more towards a growth mindset. I mean, that was probably the hugest shift I made. You know, being open to that, and there still are, so I have all sorts of blind spots where I don't realize where I do have a fixed mindset, and I'm continually working on how I can approach, you know, challenges or areas that I'm really maybe am good at with a more, more of a growth mindset. And when you do, then you'll take more challenges, you'll take more risk. And, you know, when you take those challenges and risk, that's when you'll make mistakes, and that's when you'll start to improve and you'll learn faster and I think become a better you.
Can you give an example of something that you were fixed mindset about that you changed into more of a growth mindset?
Definitely like some really like specific volleyball ones. I don't know how helpful those are. I'll see if I can think of something a little bigger, but you know, I really looked at my game. Like there's some specific positions on the court. Like you can play left side or right side. I've always played right side my whole life. And I had this belief that I just wasn't a good attacker on the left side. And I would avoid it at all costs. And I never developed any shots or any ability to attack well on the left side. And then I started to recognize that, wow, I'm really avoiding this hole in my game. I better attack it. And it was ugly at first and I'd look bad. I think that's a big part of a fixed mindset. You protect yourself from looking bad. You're worried about what others will think of you. And I didn't want to look bad. I didn't want my peers or the people I played against to think I was bad at something. But then, you know, you read the research and, you know, if I want to get better, I've got to open up my mindset and be more open to the challenges. So I started to work on it and it was ugly at first, but I've gotten better at it. I mean, that's just a small example. There's way, way bigger ones, I don't know. I can't think of anything specific now, but it's such a big part of my life with everything I do. I think being a father, my wife's big goal, we have a 5-year-old, her goal was to teach our daughter Spanish. And mine was to raise her in a growth mindset environment where, you know, anytime she did something, the feedback from me would be not that she was awesome, but that, it was really great to see her work hard at something or that she persisted and that led to good results. So I'm really trying to create that culture in our house has been a big goal of mine.
That's tough too, because it's really hard to just not say, oh, you did so great or that, or you did awesome. It's really hard to be like, oh, you worked really hard, instead of praising the work, instead of praising the action.
It's really hard. And you have to have a growth mindset about the words that you use. You have to, you know, change the habits you've created and, the culture around. And, you know, when she's at the park, every well-meaning, you know, grandma or nanny or mom is giving her growth or fixed mindset feedback. Oh, you're so beautiful. Oh, you're so smart. Oh, you're so strong. And so, you know, just address it with her, you know, and tell her, you know, people are going to tell you that you're very strong and very smart. But what they mean is you weren't born that way, that you've worked hard to become stronger. You know, you've done the monkey bars. You've explored and been adventurous since you were, you know, an infant. And that's why you've become strong. And that's helped with your intelligence. You know, it's kind of a serious conversation to have with a 2 or 3 year old, but that was important to me. So, you know, I tried to frame every opportunity to develop a growth mindset. I'd look for those chances to have those conversations.
How do you take a group of individuals, specifically in your context, a team, and start trying to instill a growth mindset into them? And how do you think that helps long term?
Well, I mean, the research shows like it helps long term because they're going to be open to taking on more challenges. But I think the way that you do it is you first talk about how the brain works, and I am definitely a novice and have a lot of growing to do in this area. I can learn a lot more about explaining how the brain works. My little understanding is that in order to grow myelin between our two neurons, there has to be, you have to, you know, create this path. So you have to do something a bunch of times to grow more myelin between your neurons. And once you do it over and over and over, then the pathway becomes stronger and you're able to do it more easily. So we talk about a little bit, you know, this is a new skill we're introducing. We want you to try to serve this way. But right now the pathway between your neurons, it's a really thick path. The grass hasn't been hacked away. But if you start to, you know, mindfully do these reps with the serve, you'll start to chip away at it and the pathway will become stronger. The myelin will grow thicker. And, you know, maybe in a couple months, I don't know, a couple days, a couple weeks, whatever it is, you won't even have to be, it won't be as painful to go through this pathway because it will have become a habit. So I think understanding and seeing, we have some, you know, some PowerPoints to take them through this and show them, you know, what's going on in the brain when you are trying to build new skills and why it is so frustrating when you're doing this, because yeah, your brain doesn't know how to do it yet. I think understanding that is a big deal and goes a long way, because you can reference that all the time when they're feeling frustrated, when you know, you're running up against some brick walls. You can have that conversation. Well, this is, you know, what's probably going on in your brain, and until that pathway is formed, it's going to be really challenging. But just know that you're hacking away at it. You're getting closer.
No, that's good. I learned that actually. I read the Talent Code, and he talks a lot about myelin and how to. I think he references the perfect practice a lot. I think there's a lot of transfer in that in any sport. When you're talking about coaching, go ahead.
Oh no, it's just, yeah, I think it's called deliberate practice. And a lot of it is having a really clear stretch goal. So something that's just beyond your reach if you want to get better at it. So I want to get better at serving, but I know how to serve, but I don't know how to serve with a jump. So that's a little bit beyond what I know how to do. So I'm going to just focus on that. I'm going to serve and jump when I hit my serve. And I'm still going to go play a bunch of volleyball. And then I'll come back and I'll serve again. And I'm going to do that over and over. So you have that one clear focus, even though all this other stuff's going on, there's passing and setting and hitting, but you're just locked in. I'm going to get a little bit better at serving. So that's your stretch goal. And then you have someone giving you feedback on how you could have done it better or what you did well. I think it's great to catch people doing it right. And so you get that feedback and then you just try it again. And that's what, I think it's the Anders Ericsson. I gave kind of an oversimplified version of what deliberate practice is. But yeah, that's how it starts. And that's how you start to, build that myelin that Daniel Coyle talked about in the Talent Code.
So I want to talk about a couple of things that you said there. First off, you said that you want to isolate on one aspect of your game, but still be playing the entire game. So can you touch on why we want to not just focus on one skill that you're trying to build up, but also incorporate that into the whole concept?
Yeah, well, yeah, there's a lot of research in the field called motor learning that that they've studied. There's about, I don't know, 50 years of studying what sort of practice leads to the best transfer. So, you know, how can we make practice help us the most when we get to tournament time? And there's a lot in there. One thing is that practice needs to look as much like the game as possible. So if we're doing something in practice where a coach serves the ball or sets the ball or tosses you an easy ball, then that's not going to happen in the match. You're not going to get an easy ball from a coach tossed to you. So that's not going to transfer to a match. So we want to have people hitting tough serves and trying to make things hard on us as often as possible, because that's what matches look like. So we want to be really, it's called the law of specificity. So we want to be, yeah, as specific to what our competition looks like. Yeah, I think the other part of it is that, especially in volleyball, the game is random. You never get to serve 20 balls in a row. In basketball, you never get to shoot 50 free throws in a row. In golf, you don't get to putt 50 putts in a row. So we want to do things, again, like the game are. Even though it feels good doing this, like I'm going to shoot a jump shot from the same spot 20 times, it feels good, and you're probably in the moment, you feel like you're getting a little bit better. But after about 3 or 4 reps, your brain starts to turn off. It doesn't, it's not thinking, it's not challenged anymore. It's not trying to figure out how far away from the hoop you are, how much you need to follow through. It's just kind of going into autopilot. So what you want to do is do things randomly, shoot from one spot, and then move and shoot from another spot. And then you're having to calculate and figure out, all this stuff in your brain to figure out what sort of touch you need. And then, the best is when it's with defense and all that as well. But I think if you can keep that in mind, that we want things to be random, because then you're being challenged, you're challenging your brain. And that's also, again, closer to what the tournament, what the game looks like. So I think there's traps with the block training where you do the same thing over and over for coaches, because it does feel really comfortable and it feels like you're getting better. And I think everyone walks away feeling good about themselves. But the research shows, there's tons of studies, block training leads to inferior results to more random game-like training.
And the second part that I want to touch on is the feedback aspect of giving. You said you want to catch them when they're doing something right, maybe opposed to what traditionally I've seen in both military and sports, is you catch them when they're doing it wrong and then you correct that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a hard thing to do. Because again, I think it comes from a good place. Like, as teachers, as leaders, we want to help people. And if we see them struggling, we want to point it out and help them get better. But I was actually reading an article today, and I can send it over to you, from Dr. Gabriel Wolf, who did a big study on golf. And one of the big findings was when you caught people doing it right, the transfer was way higher. Like, the next day, the groups that had feedback that was not necessarily positive reinforcement, but productive reinforcement, like, that's what it feels like when you, catching them when they did it the right way. They found that group was able to carry over some of those practices more than a control group that either got negative feedback or no feedback. So I'm still, I think there's some stuff about, like, the dopamine you get. I still have a lot more to learn about why that is. But I think it makes some common sense why it feels good. If you're a learner and you're someone who's trying to improve, and you're just getting beaten down over and over, and someone's just noticing all the mistakes, then I don't think you're going to want to challenge yourself as often. You're probably not going to want to be in that zone where you are failing. So if you have someone who's kind of in your corner and catching you doing it right, and maybe looks over the mistakes you make, then you're just going to keep pushing and keep challenging yourself. I do think it is important to give feedback and to help people improve when there are errors that are common, they're doing the same mistake over and over. I think that's a great time to step in and guide that person to maybe a more productive movement pattern or whatever it is that they're working on.
You've kind of touched on, I don't know what the term is, but when you, like, the game-like training, I guess. But you also mentioned block training. Can you kind of give an example of what block training is, and then if there's ever a time to do that?
Yeah, so block training is, it's when you're, yeah, so if you just shot, we'll just go back to basketball. I feel like most people know basketball. If you just shot 100 free throws in a row, you're just shooting from the same spot over and over and over. The time that block training, from my understanding of the research, is when it's valuable, is when you're introducing a new skill. So if someone, I can think of a volleyball one, can go back to the jump float serve. So someone's only served where they hit a standing float, and we're going to introduce this jump float. So it's a new skill for them, a new concept, and it's a new movement pattern. So they need to understand what it feels like to do it. They need to understand, how to move. What it feels like. So you do it in a block setting. You want it to be controlled. You want the environment to be comfortable. And it's not because that's going to make them better at the jump, float, serve, but it's because it's going to get them an understanding of what that movement feels like and is like. So then once you introduce it and once they get some chances to do it in that environment, which is usually a lot shorter than most people do, I don't know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, it probably depends on the skill. Then you want to throw them out into the wild and let them try this new skill in as game-like manner, as game-like situation as possible. Because, you know, when you actually serve, there's tons of stresses. You know, there's pressure, there's score, there's other things, other factors. And you want to have to learn how to develop the skills to be good under pressure or be able to serve and then go play defense. And so you have to practice that because no one's born knowing how to have a routine where they're not worried about the score, but they're just focused on their target. So that's, you know, that's all just practice that you need in game like situations. So you're prepared for those moments when the stresses of competition come.
I like that. That sounds good. All right. So I'm going to throw two scenarios at you. We'll do one at a time, trying to make these as, volleyball specific as possible, but there's definitely a lot of transfer. All right, so let's say you have a team of adults, okay, that you are required to coach, and they've never played the sport of volleyball in their lives, and you're training them. You have 6 months to train them for nationals. Where would you start, and what kind of progression would you take them through?
Yeah, so I think a big key is always to meet your learner where they're at. So you want to think about and remember what it's like to be a beginner at something. So I think that's an important thing for any coach, any leader, just try to get an understanding of where your learner's at. And I'm sure all these adults would be in different places. Maybe some of them have played once or twice before and some of them have never played. So I'd want to do that for sure. But I think the first thing is I know that people have a limited ability to process information. So I'd want to, and I have these keys for each skill. So I want to, for passing, for example, that's one of the most important skills in volleyball. It's kind of the foundation of the game, passing with your platform. So passing, I have five keys that I like to use for all the different parts of passing. One of them is about the way we move. One of them's about where your eyes are looking on the other side, trying to read the other side. One of them's about what you're doing with your platform, and so on. So then I would introduce the keys to the new volleyball players in the most basic way I could. And we just go one key at a time. So first we're going to focus on our platform. We just want to see you start straight and finish simple. And I would demo it. I would show them what it looks like. I'd have one of the players come demo it so everyone could see, you know, and see them maybe mess it up a little bit. And then we'd go with a partner off the toss, and we'd toss to the passer, and they'd just work on their straight and then simple and just focus on that one key so they got an understanding of it. Maybe even we'd put an iPad out and use an app that has a video delay so they could do it and then go look at themselves and see what it looked like. Because usually that's a better than anything I can say as a coach. So we'd go through that with each skill. So there's passing, serving, attacking, blocking, defense, setting. And so we'd go through all those and introduce these keys in a very blocked setting. And then once that was in place, we'd throw them out into the wild and give them, okay, today we're going to play. But, you know, this person, I could see you struggled with straight and simple. This other person, you struggled with moving your feet the way we want to shuffle to move. So that's going to be your focus. You know, there's going to be all sorts of stuff going on. You're going to pass and set and hit, but just going to have you try to focus on the one key that we're on, not to focus on 100 things, but just this one simple key that we've taught to you. So I think that would be one step. I'd probably want to do a lot of modeling with bringing in film from YouTube and showing people, you know, how college players play and just so they can start to understand what it looks like. And then it's just getting tons of reps and, you know, building that myelin from neuron to neuron and probably hopefully catching them doing it right a bunch and repeat for about 6 months.
So would you bring like the YouTube videos in to show them what correct looks like and take a practice time to do that? Or would you send that to them and have them watch that on their own time?
I would do it pre-practice. So whatever so if for the day we're working on passing, I would have some clips already picked out and show them some clips and try to make it as much as possible. Ask them what they saw and less of me telling them what I saw, but try to get them, you know, studying it, not just watching it or being entertained by it, but really studying it and trying to figure out, oh yeah, what is Karch Karai doing when he passes the ball? What is Carrie Walsh doing when she passes the ball? And have them look for that and maybe point out some of the keys. Yeah, that's what straight and simple looks like. That's what it looks like when you shuffle to move, when you move your feet. And then they, you know, that doesn't mean they're going to know how to do it. We learn by doing. But it's nice to have that visual, to have that model. And I think it helps in the learning process. But I think for sure it helps the film practice. And then in a one-on-one setting, watch, you know, have them watch it with you. And there you can get a little more specific for what each person needs. And I think the one-on-one settings where you can start to really build some trust, I think it's such an important part of being a leader or a teacher. I think one of the big mistakes I made early and probably still make as a coach is I just want to teach technique or teach all this good stuff I know about my sport. But until that person knows that you care about them, that they can trust you, that you're committed to excellence, then they're not going to buy into it. They're just going to try to, they're going to be uncomfortable. They're going to be maybe in a place of fear. And they're not going to be open to being vulnerable and looking bad and making mistakes. So I think I probably should have brought up earlier, but just such a big first step is those three things, showing them how much you care about them, not just because they're able to pass the ball well, but because you care about them as a human being. And then showing that you're committed to excellence and that you are a learner and want to be great at what you do, then I think they'll start to be open to the feedback you give them and be open to making mistakes in front of you and the people around them. So I think in building any culture, I think that's just such a huge first step to do that.
You mentioned as far as like you want to, I'm sorry, what you just said there about showing them that you care about them and showing them that you care about or strive for excellence. Is there like research that backs up why that's important?
Yeah. I think some of it's like evolutionary. We are tribal people, and I don't think you could survive if you weren't part of the group. So we're always like kind of looking around, am I part of the group? Do I fit in? And if we didn't, then we'd die. We'd be, you know, live in a state of fear. I know there's something to do with like the amygdala. That's some part of it. But again, I don't know if I'm able to explain it properly, but yeah. So until there's that like sense of belonging that you're part of the tribe, part of the group, then, I don't think you'll feel comfortable to be yourself. But once you do feel that, like, hey, you're one of us, we care about you, we're going to protect you, we're going to look out for you, even when you fail, when you make mistakes, you're part of our tribe, then people can be themselves. And when you can be yourself, then you can push yourself and start to become a high performer. I think there's more to it even than that, but I think that's like a big part of it.
The reason I ask is because I come from a culture where telling people that you care about them and all that kind of stuff really is kind of the opposite of what we do in our training methodology. So I'd be curious to see if there's any, that's why I asked if there's any studies on it.
Yeah, no, I think it's, and in coaching too, for a long time, you know, the coach knows everything and is supposed to tell you what you're doing wrong. And you go hang out with your friends and do your thing after that. And, you know, we live in these separate worlds, but there's a great book called The Culture Code by Daniel Coyle. We already talked about Daniel Coyle, but he goes into that more. Safety is so important because you're either in a safe place where you feel loved and cared about, or you're in fear. And yeah, I think your amygdala goes one way or the other, like the whole fight or flight way. And to have a I think to have a culture and a group going the same direction and connected, I think you've got to feel like you belong. And there's all these belonging cues he talks about in the book, you know, things like, you know, your body language, having eye contact, even like, you know, meeting in circles. Like when we meet, we're touching, we're brushing shoulders. So there's all sorts of ways that you can show that you're connected. It doesn't necessarily have to be like, you know, really fluffy or soft in that way. But I think there's different ways to show that someone belongs to your tribe, to your group. I think it's on the leader and on the rest of the group to figure out how you can make people feel as safe and as welcomed as possible. And the sooner you do that, the sooner people can be real with you. They can tell you, you know, where you aren't as efficient or where you do need to upgrade some area of your performance. I think that's something that I'm trying to figure out how to do it better and will constantly be working at, because I think everyone, there's different things that need to go on for them to feel connected, to feel a part of the group. And that's the fun part about being a leader or a coach, is that there's always just challenges with it. It's such an art, and one that I'll just continually try to get better at.
So do you think that, I mean, that's super important to be on a team. If you're on a team with somebody, to be able to tell them like, hey, you need to pick this up, or you know, have those honest conversations with teammates. Do you think that that's a good rationale to, if you don't have that trust built up first, then that's going to be poorly received or not received at all? Do you think that's a necessity to, before somebody's going to be able to take that kind of feedback?
I don't know if like across the board, I'm sure some people maybe could take it. I think to take really authentic feedback, like stuff that not just stuff on the surface, but like real stuff that goes down to who you are, like, I don't know, areas of your personality that could make you a better teammate or player, like to hear that sort of stuff is pretty hard unless you trust the person next to you. Like, you don't want to hear that from someone that you don't feel like cares about you. If you don't feel like they care about you, then it just becomes like, oh, I'm going to rebel against them. Like, I'll show them. Like, I'm not like that. I'm going to, you know, it becomes more of a fight I think just more of a fight. So I think to get, people on the same page, then you've got to show that you care about them. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure, and you probably know better, I'm sure there's been a lot of leaders who have led in a way where they were pretty led from a place of fear. But I think that's a little more short term. My understanding of the research is that can work in the short term and for a short period of time, but in the end ends up leading to more dysfunction. I think for like long term sustained excellence, you've got to feel a sense of belonging, and otherwise you start to plateau and stop challenging yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I can think of probably 100 leaders that I've had who have been that really horrible example of how to lead, but you definitely do remember the ones who are super, as we say it, technically and technically proficient at their job, and are also, you know, have that like honest mentality of like, they just want to see other people get better too. Not like, hey, I'm good at this, why aren't you good at this kind of thing. So,
I was thinking about it. We had a guest on our podcast, named Lorraine Davies, and she really does study this stuff. And she was saying everyone, especially when they're coming into a new group, they're asking 3 unconscious questions. They're not actually saying these in her head, but this is what they're trying to figure out is, do you care about me? Can I trust you? And are you committed to excellence? So they're just kind of coming into the group and those things are going on in your head and taking that in. And if you don't feel like those questions are answered, then you go to that place of fear, you protect yourself, the fixed mindset comes out. And I think that's kind of the end of the deal. You stay who you are. But if those questions are answered, they care about me, I trust them, and they're committed to excellence, like, I'm all in. Yeah, I'll try that. Try to get better at, you know, you're saying I have weaknesses here. Okay. Like, I know you care about me, so I'm going to go for it. But, yeah, I think it's good to think about that. Anytime you're bringing new people into your group or starting a new culture, just recognize that's what people are asking themselves about you.
So for the second scenario, well, first let me ask a question on the first scenario. If you had the same situation, except for everybody, instead of having all new volleyball players, you had all just volleyball players with horrible, horrible habits. Would you change anything, or would you still use the same format?
Oh, I'd try to change them. So if they had like really poor biomechanics or...
No, I say, would you change the format of how you prepare for the tournament, or would you still do the block training real quick to kind of show what right looks like and then jump into playing?
Yeah, I would still try to make changes. I'd first introduce the growth mindset and let them know that if they practice it, they'll get better at it. So yeah, I would.
Okay. So the second scenario is you have a group of individuals who have never played a sport in their entire life, and you have to teach them how to play volleyball, basketball, baseball, and golf. How do you approach it?
Well, I think my first thing for that scenario would be, at first, like we talked about, I'd try to welcome them into the team and figure out ways to make them feel safe. But once I did that, I would probably, as if they're a non-athlete, and maybe I'm going to guess because they haven't done sports is that they had bad experiences with it, I would try to figure out a way to make it as fun as possible. And I probably wouldn't try to teach them some perfect technique or go over maybe some more mundane or boring parts of it. I would figure out some sort of like, I'm thinking even of my daughter who we're doing soccer with, who, you know, she can't play like really play soccer. So we play like freeze tag where she, you know, her and my wife will have to dribble the ball around our backyard and I go try to tag them and make them freeze. And then all of a sudden it kind of becomes fun. And she's, you know, not that she's going to, there's not going to be a lot of transfer to soccer, but she's starting to have a positive association with soccer. Like, oh, this is fun. And then, oh yeah, Dad, I want to go. We do that again tomorrow. And so, yeah, I just try to figure out ways to make it as fun as possible and maybe look for like the most enjoyable parts of each game. Like for volleyball, I think jumping and spiking is a pretty cool thing, and just giving people chances. Yeah, let's just go try. I'll toss balls and you go ahead and try to hit it as hard as you can. And maybe that'll get them to come back the next day.
Because that's something that we're in the military, you have, we don't really like specificity is for the birds. We kind of, we're very generalist. We have a lot of tasks that we have to be super proficient in, and it runs the gamut. So that's kind of why I threw that question at you, to see how you would take an approach when you're training a lot of different things over like a wide gamut of skill sets.
Yeah. Yeah, then I don't know if my answer helped you, because I don't know how important fun is for you.
I mean, it's definitely like, I think it's underrated for sure, because I love the military. This is like, it's the coolest job ever. But, you know, it's fun for me, and I really enjoy, I like shooting, I like jumping out of airplanes, I like doing all that kind of stuff. So that's all fun for me. But initially, a lot of people do not find it fun. So you're having to teach, like, it's like you're getting guys to drink from a fire hose and trying to balance them keep coming back for more kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's where I guess you'd want a balance of teaching people to do things proficiently and some of the mundane tasks, but also look for chances to give your brain a break and do something a little more exciting. But I think even if there's like, it feels like there's a lot, and I think no matter what you're doing, like, I mean, volleyball is a pretty simple game. You bump the ball over the net, but if you really get to a high level of it, like, there's so much detail to think about and so many areas you can improve on, but you can't improve on all of it at once. So you just focus on one little thing at a time. And then once you get better at that, you move on to the next. And I'd imagine you could do that in the military as well.
Oh, as long as you have the long game.
Yeah. I think you just got to have the long game in mind too. Like, it can't be like this instant gratification, like I'm going to get it all down this week. It's just understanding, like learning takes time, and I'm going to commit and I'm going to enjoy the progress I do make in this one area and be okay that the other areas, you know, still need work, and I'm going to get to them when I can. So
no, it's something that I've definitely incorporated into my my own development and my own training. I actually learned it from your podcast, where when we're talking about breaking down certain skill sets, you know, for us it might be drawing, you know, my gun out of my holster and shooting around on a paper target. Well, there's a lot of things that go into that, and I might be focusing on one of those subtasks to achieve that greater task, and I'm trying to break, you know, that shot down and get it faster and faster. And then every 10th of a second that I can shave off of my time is a huge win for me, because it's a super complex skill. So we can definitely do that. Whether we do or not is a completely different conversation.
Yeah. Well, it takes, I think you have to learn that. I didn't know that. I would focus on too many things at once and be overwhelmed. And luckily I had some good mentors who taught me that. But yeah, I mean, you know, when you go jump and spike, I mean, I would focus on the size and the speed and just these little details in my first step, and just focus on that for days and weeks at a time. And I'd watch film on it, and I'd, you know, get feedback from my coach, and there's all these results that can throw you off that task. Like, you know, maybe sometimes the result was good and sometimes the result was bad. But if you're really locked in on the process of, I'm going to make this step small, and I know what I want it to be like, then the results start to come. But it really takes, I think it's really hard to not get distracted by the results or all the other factors that go into it. But just buying into, I'm going to get better at this one small part of the process. Once I can do that 9 out of 10 proficiently, I'm going to move on to the next small step. And eventually you get pretty good at stuff if you do that.
When you talked about video feedback, do you find it easier to use like you were saying earlier, like a delayed feedback loop, or an app more like Coach's Eye, where you can actually like draw on it to show where the deficiency is?
I think either one is good. And it might depend on what you're doing and kind of what the amount of coaches you have. The nice thing, I guess, for either one, like, you know, you can just have a tripod set up and you don't even need a coach there. Like that you can, or, you know, a team leader, they can do the task and then just go look at it on their own. So I think either one is great. And I think there's just so many things you don't realize you're doing until you have that film to look on. And then it just brings so much awareness that, oh, wow, that's what I'm doing. That's it. Okay. Now I'm going to go work on it and change it.
When you, if you use film to like break down your approach, for example, would you go look at it like every single time, or would you hit a few and kind of see generally what you're doing wrong?
I'd do more of a few. I think reps are so important. You're not going to build the myelin between the neurons without the rep. Like that's not going to make the pathway stronger just watching yourself do it. So I think, you know, maybe it's you do 4 or 5 and then you go take a look, and then, but yeah, I think you want to be very conscious of taking away from reps. You want the reps to be really mindful. I'd rather have really quality mindful reps than a bunch of mindless ones where you're not focused on one clear task. But yeah, I think there's a balance between knowing how often to look. And I think if you like have seen it a couple times, you should start to have an understanding of what you're doing. Now it's just actually, you know, building that habit into your brain so you're able to do it more often.
Well, awesome. I really appreciate you coming on and talking to me about all this stuff.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I hope I didn't, I don't know if I rambled on, and I wish I have a lot of practice to do in being able to explain things simply and in a helpful way. So I hope there's a couple takeaways in there.
Oh, definitely were. So do you have people follow you, or do you want or encourage people to reach out to you, or?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I don't have any social media, I have the podcast, Put Your Brains Out. Those volleyball fans, but I think a lot of it transfers to hopefully beyond volleyball. I hope so. But yeah, anyone can email me at I guess my LMU one's good. john.mayer@lmu.edu. I'd be happy to talk more.
Awesome. Thanks, John. All right, so that concludes our interview with the Coach Your Brains Out team right now. If there's a large cry for me to have the rest of them on, I will. But I don't know if that's really going to happen. So let's get into our resources for this week. So for our civilian resource, we're going to talk about is another book recommendation that I got from the Coach Your Brains Out podcast. It's called Legacy. It's by James Kerr. And it's What the All Blacks Can Teach Us About the Business of Life. So the All Blacks are a rugby team. I believe they're the most winningest rugby team or sports team in history. It's a really good book, and it talks a lot about culture and how these professional athletes kind of maintain their culture to be a winning one, and how they bring up younger players and how they stay humble. It's a really good book. They also did an interview with James Kerr on their podcast. It's one of their early podcasts. I recommend checking that out after you read the book because it'll give you some more insights. So I hope you guys enjoyed this two-part series from the Coach Your Brains Out team. Be sure to check them out at their podcast on iTunes, Coach Your Brains Out. Give them a review. Check out their episodes that I'm going to put in the show notes and give them a 5-star review because they're awesome and of what they do. If you have any questions, comments, and concerns for me, feel free to reach out to me at ncopd@protonmail.com. Till next time. Peace, you know it's gonna hurt more. You better realize what you're looking for.